Hi everyone, my name is Heather Vorych, a cardiologist and author, invited to record a series of podcasts at the intersection of heart failure and palliative care. In the first episode of this series, I introduce listeners to some of the very basic questions. What is heart failure and what is palliative care? And why should we even care about delivering palliative care to patients with heart failure? In this second episode, I will talk about integrating heart failure care with palliative care and provide some tips for those who are interested in doing this. On Twitter, @WorkInMinerva asked, I would appreciate feedback from cardiology providers about barriers to more integration of palliative care. Physician Dr. Daniel Schwartz @Dr. Schwartz asked, how when do people introduce palliative care when someone is first referred for heart failure care? Build rapport first, discuss palliative care later, offer it as one of many options. Does it limit opportunity to give hope too? I will address these questions in this episode. But before I do so, I want to share a story. This is a story that I wrote about in the New York Times all the way back in 2013. And it is one of the most powerful stories that I've been a part of and really helped align me and my career in being focused on this important topic. The title of this story was The Cancer of Optimism. I met her in 2011 during my first few weeks as an intern in internal medicine. She was not the kind of patient who had appeared in my textbooks. She had been admitted from rehab after expressing an intent to take her own life, and I soon learned that her body was as troubled as her mind. She had heart failure from a condition called hypertrophic obstructive cardiomyopathy, in which an overgrown muscular wall keeps blood from properly flowing out of the heart. She might have been born with it, or acquired it from years of neglected high blood pressure. Her blood pooled in her swelling legs and seeped into her lungs, causing her to wheeze constantly. She was in her late 50s, but seemed much older. While learning her medical history, I also got to know about her. A former artist derailed by addiction, she had become alienated from her career and her family. She had let the problems in her heart fester and had never received consistent treatment. At this point, she wasn't a suitable candidate for heart surgery, but I felt that there was still hope. A procedure called alcohol septal ablation could potentially reduce her symptoms. It involved injecting alcohol into a blood vessel to strangle the blood supply to the muscular part of the heart obstructing blood flow. The patient was desperate to have the procedure performed. She hoped to experience a life outside of hospitals, to reconnect with her family, to start painting again. With my sense of righteous optimism intact from my medical school days, I convinced the other doctors that in spite of the risks, we should try it. The procedure was uneventful, but when I was updated on the patient's condition the next morning, I was stunned. Overnight, she had gone into complete heart block, a failure of the electrical transmissions that caused the heart to beat. A rare but known complication of the procedure. She temporarily lost her pulse, underwent CPR and electrical defibrillation. A pacemaker had to be inserted. She was transferred to the intensive care unit. Later in the day, the complications cascaded, and she found herself buried again under the flexed wrists of medical residents and nurses, pushing her sternum into a doughy pulp. After half an hour of frenzied CPR, infusions, electrical shocks, and other assorted Hail Marys, resuscitation was called off. As the silhouettes and scrubs withdrew from her bed, she lay there limp, dead. This was not the way this story was supposed to end, certainly not how I had imagined it would. To me, this story, in retrospect, shows what are the challenges of taking care of patients with heart failure. It can be very hard to assess the prognosis of these patients, Many of them have to undergo procedures and tests that can sometimes carry extraordinary risks. And in this case, particularly, the reason I felt that I had failed her was because even though I had prepared her for plan A, which was what would happen if everything went to plan, but I never talked to her about plan B, about what might happen if things don't. Over the years, though, I've thought about that case and many others, and feel that right now I'm in a position to provide some help to others who might be struggling with similar questions. And in this podcast, I'll provide some tips about how best to integrate palliative care concepts for patients with heart failure. On Twitter, Jake Varney asked, "What are the best prognostic tools/calculators, and how accurate and reliable are they? Prognosis drives goals of care discussions." This leads us to tip one. Prognosis is unpredictable in heart failure, and many patients and physicians overestimate survival. The variable clinical course of heart failure makes accurate assessment of prognosis challenging for both patients and physicians. So from a palliative care perspective, this is important since many discussions about advanced care planning and what type of care patients might want requires patients to have realistic assessment of their expected survival. This is particularly important not only when considering placement of devices such as pacemakers, defibrillators, and left ventricular assist devices, also called LVADs, but also with regards to transitioning towards a comfort-focused plan of care. Educating, guiding, and counseling terminally ill heart failure patients is therefore a critical first step for palliative care clinicians. This might be done in conjunction with other healthcare professionals caring for the patient. It is common for patients with advanced heart failure to have good days, which further confounds their assessment of prognosis. Risk factors such as the Seattle Heart Failure Model and the MAGIC score are modestly accurate and can help palliative care clinicians estimate prognosis in heart failure patients. Cardiology guidelines suggest that such models be integrated in clinical practice. On Facebook, Bart Vindram asked, "I would appreciate a complete rundown on the full ranges of alternatives to pacemakers and guidelines for appropriateness and trade-offs." This leads us to tip number two. Have thorough and thoughtful discussions about implantable cardioverter defibrillators and pacemakers in terminally ill heart failure patients. Patients with heart failure with reduced ejection fraction frequently have implantable cardioverter defibrillators placed, and the purpose for these is to prevent sudden death from arrhythmias such as ventricular tachycardia or ventricular fibrillation. ICDs, as they're called, terminate these arrhythmias either through pacing the heart at a rate faster than the arrhythmia or through electric shocks, also called defibrillation. Defibrillation, however, can be traumatic and can contribute to the development of PTSD in some patients. Although ICDs improve survival in some patients, their benefit in advanced heart failure is less clear, and a fifth of patients who receive ICDs receive electric shocks in the last few weeks of life. Therefore, it is very important for clinicians to discuss changes to the settings of these devices as patients approach end of life. A video decision aid developed by the Colorado Program for Patient-Centered Decisions can be used to guide patients through the decision-making process. ICD therapy should be distinguished from cardiac resynchronization therapy, also called CRT, in which patients with a left bundle branch block and a low ejection fraction are provided biventricular pacing support. Given that CRT can improve symptoms and quality of life in heart failure patients, this function should be retained if aligned with patients' wishes. Some patients and family members will have questions about device removal after death. No device needs to be taken out and can be left in place after a patient passes away. Maggie M. at Death in Grasp asked if I've had patients ask if they can deactivate their pacemaker when actively dying. Can you cover this difficult subject? I had one patient in 8 years whose cardiologist was willing to do it. This goes to a fundamental right that patients have, that if they have an artificial device in their body, at any point, they have the right to choose to turn it off. This includes both defibrillators and pacemakers. And while this is a difficult situation, in this case and in all other similar cases, patients' wishes should be respected. The next tip is, when it comes to diuresis, be aggressive, and be creative. Now, while furosemide, or Lasix, is really the hallmark of diuretic therapy, if it stops working, there are many options that clinicians have. The first one should always be increasing the dose, which usually involves doubling the dose. If that doesn't work, then a switch to another type of therapy such as torsemide or bumetanide may be considered. If this fails as well, try giving a dose of metolazone, which can sometimes have a very effective diuretic effect, although it can cause a lot of electrolyte derangements, namely hypokalemia. If this doesn't work as well, it may be important for a patient to have intravenous furosemide. This is where partnering with a same-day heart failure access clinic or some type of hospice service that can provide these outpatient therapies should be considered. The next tip is that even though when we think of heart failure, we mostly think about shortness of breath, shortness of breath is just one of many burdensome symptoms that patients with heart failure have. In a study that we conducted, we found that symptoms such as depression, anxiety, ascites, which is swelling in the stomach, fatigue, are all extremely common in patients with heart failure, and therefore palliative care clinicians or clinicians taking care of patients with heart failure need to be trained in addressing all these symptoms, not just shortness of breath. The next tip is, many heart failure therapies such as ACE inhibitors and beta blockers actually improve symptoms and quality of life, not just long-term survival. So even though when patients with heart failure, when they're receiving palliative care or hospice care, we think about trying to simplify their medications, it might be important to be thoughtful about some of these heart failure therapies, given that they might actually help patients feel better as well. Another important point is that ejection fraction actually does not predict survival in older heart failure patients. Now, heart failure patients are usually divided into patients with low ejection fraction and patients who have a normal ejection fraction. However, ejection fraction might not be strongly associated with prognosis, especially in older patients. In a recent study of Medicare patients, there was actually no difference noted in survival between patients with low versus normal ejection fraction. In fact, we have shown that patients with normal ejection fraction, also called HFpEF, can actually have worse quality of life and more comorbidities than patients with low ejection fraction. In fact, given that patients with HFpEF tend to be older than patients with low ejection fraction and that they don't really have any real disease-modifying therapies that improve survival, this population should be particularly targeted with palliative care because of the limited conventional therapeutic options that they have. When it comes to hospice, I think it is important to first recognize that very few patients with heart failure are actually referred to hospice. And of those that are referred to hospice, many patients actually disenroll from hospice and are readmitted to the hospital. And this is because many times, hospice just does not have the type of services needed to be able to take care of these patients, or that patients were not prepared for hospice philosophy, which aims to manage patients outside of the setting of a hospital, but rather at home or in hospice facility. But perhaps the biggest challenge that remains for hospice patients who have heart failure is that heart failure patients are referred to hospice too late. In fact, we have shown that the median survival of patients with heart failure who are discharged to hospice from the hospital is only 11 days, and that a quarter of these patients die within the first 3 days of being enrolled in hospice. Such late referrals to hospice are not just confined to that. Even when patients with heart failure are referred to palliative care, which should technically occur much upstream of hospice, is still late. In fact, according to a national study that we performed, a third of patients with heart failure, when they're referred to specialty palliative care, are bedbound. This compares to only about 10% of patients with cancer who are that sick. So the most important tip that I can give to better integrate heart failure care and palliative care is to push upstream when we think of palliative care, whether it is through ourselves as primary palliative care or when we refer patients to additional specialty services, such as a palliative care consultation or even to hospice. Some centers will actually have an automatic consultation to palliative care for patients who meet a specific risk criteria after they're hospitalized. As far as I'm concerned, really any patient with heart failure who who is admitted to the hospital should be considered strongly for palliative care. Thank you so much for listening to this podcast. And in the next episode, we will talk about a special population of patients with heart failure, patients who have left ventricular assist devices, also called LVADs. Thank you so much for listening and for your interest in integrating palliative care in patients who have heart failure.